So hello and welcome to the final podcast of 2022, my podcast, which I called at the start of the year, Tales from the Battlefields. And I never imagined that come the end of the year, I'd have produced, I think it's 28 or 29 episodes, and I'd still be going. I just thought it would be, you know, an experiment and a bit of fun that a few people would listen to, and then that would be it. But thank you very much for everyone that's supported me and contacted me and downloaded and listened to all these podcasts this year. It's been an extraordinary experience for me, and I've got lots of ideas for next year. And one of the highlights from this year has been the contact that I've had from lots of listeners, emails, research projects that people have sent to me, and I've been able to discover what happened to people's relatives. And in one case, a couple from Australia that contacted me in the early days of the podcast during the summer, they came over to Belgium, and it was an incredible experience taking them on the journey, showing them where their relatives fell during the First World War. I never imagined that I'd be doing that when I started the podcast back in February. So one thing I wanted to clarify from the last podcast that I did, when we interviewed Megan Kelleher from the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, we were talking about the family inscriptions and the number of characters. And as everybody knows, or most people will know, there were 66 characters, including spaces, that were initially allowed by the Imperial War Graves Commission. That rule was put into place after the end of the First World War, when the Portland headstones were established. And I made a comment that I thought that during the Second World War, the number of characters allowed had increased. I think I said to 120. Now, that comment came out of the air, really. I don't know where I got that from. We can't find, I've had people from the commission looking at this, and we can't find any evidence at all that the number of characters permitted was increased to 120. However, I think I've got this from wandering around the cemeteries in the Bayeux Cemetery, where there's a number of headstones that have got a lot more than 66 characters on there. So there's definitely headstones out. There's always an exception to every rule. But one thing that Simon Bendry, who I wish to thank very much from the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, has pointed out, that the rule today is four lines are allowed with a maximum of 25 characters per line. And by my basic arithmetic, that means that today soldiers, if they die in action, get a Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone, would be allowed a maximum of 100 characters rather than the 66 which was initially allowed. So I hope I've cleared that up, and sorry for any confusion there. So this week I recorded a podcast a couple of weeks ago during my final visit of the year to the Ypres Salient, where I met Johan de Jong, a man that I've known for several years. He lives just about 500 yards away from Tynecott Cemetery, the largest Commonwealth War Graves Commission anywhere in the world, with nearly 12,000 burials there. And he knows so much about so many of the graves in Tynecott. I thought it would be a good idea to have a wander around the cemetery and record some of the stories that Johan has told. He's a local battlefield guide. And it's always, to me, a much more interesting perspective if we get a local's perspective on what happened at Tynecott and at Passchendaele in 1917. So without any more ado, let's go over to Tynecott and talk to Johan. So we're now standing on one of the most iconic places anywhere on the Western Front. And we're standing in what is the largest Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery anywhere in the world. But we're here not with a British guide, we're here with a local Belgium guide who actually lives just a few hundred yards away from Tynecott. And what I thought would be a good idea would be to explore cemetery, to look at some of the individual stories here in amongst the nearly 12,000 that are here, and to find out a bit about what it's like to live in the middle of one of the most iconic battlefields in the world. So please, Johan, would you like to introduce yourself first of all and tell us how you got interested in all this in the first place?
Hello, my name is Johan de Jonge. I'm local. I live in Passchendaele in the countryside. And when we were growing up, we were walking over the field together with my father, looking for shrapnel balls, for some pieces of driving bands from brass, rifle bullets, etc. And starting a small collection. And later when I grow up, we visit the cemeteries. And then I try to find out, why are these guys buried here? What is their story? And so I get involved in searching the story behind the soldiers. And in the same time, I get involved with local historical guides who work for the Memorial Museum Passchendaele. And I rolled into the complete working of the Memorial Museum Passchendaele. I am the responsible for the guides, for the volunteers of the Memorial Museum. We are doing all kinds of memorial events, big events, small events, all kinds of this stuff to remember all the soldiers that lost their lives here.
I think you do more than that as well, because I first met you in 2018 when we arrived here with thousands of people with the Royal British Legion GP90 with Ledger. And, I can't remember the numbers now. It was many thousands of people we had here. And I met you in the car park where you'd got a tea stand and you were serving tea to everybody, weren't you?
Yes, during the Armistice weekend with our society, which is called the Passchendaele Society 1917, we are offering free coffee and tea to all the visitors of Tynecot Cemetery. This is together with the community of Sonnebeek. And this is to say thank you to all the pilgrims that come over and pay respect to those guys that fell here on our soil and here in Passchendaele.
And that was very, very welcome. So that was, in fact, the Armistice tour, was it? Not the GP91. So that was in the November that we came here.
Yeah, that's right, isn't it?
That was fantastic. I'll never ever forget that. Now, the cemetery today looks very different to the last time I was here a few weeks ago. All of the roses, just a few roses, are still there in their final days. Yesterday was very foggy. Today's a bit misty, but it's very, very quiet. There's not many people here. I think apart from us, I can see three people in the cemetery. The leaves are just about coming off the trees. And just before we started this interview, Johan, you were telling me about the Moonlight Massacre, and we're approaching the 105 years anniversary of that. And you've got a special event that you're going to be in charge of that's going to take place on Friday, which is the 2nd of December. Is that right? Tell us about the Moonlight Massacre.
Well, everybody is thinking that the Third Battle of Ypres, Battle of Passchendaele, ended on November the 10th or on November the 20th with the start of the Battle of Cambrai. But in fact, there were a few other small attacks here during this Third Battle of Ypres. And one of the attacks was on the December the 2nd, 1917. And the meaning was from the east side of Passchendaele to attack a few remaining German bunkers and to make sure that the road between Passchendaele and the village West Rozebeke was in British hands. This attack was planned during the night, but it was full moon and a clear sky. And so the Germans had a perfect target to shoot on the British soldiers. A lot of British soldiers were killed there. And a few years ago, a British doctor, Professor Michael Lotticero, wrote a book about it. He did a big research to it because he couldn't understand why on December the 2nd was a big attack and it was never mentioned in some war diaries. And he did the research and he found out the complete story of two British divisions that attacked Passchendaele. And in 2017, there was a small commemoration plaque inaugurated on a farm called Tansenhout, which is between Passchendaele and West Rozebeek. And next Friday, December the 2nd, is the 105th anniversary. And we will do a commemoration event together with Dr. Michael Lotticero.
That's fantastic. I think the thing that struck that when you were talking to me, I kept thinking, oh, this must have been a small attack, like a small raid. You just mentioned there was two divisions involved. That's amazing. Let's start talking about one or two of the stories as we wander around. So we've come to our first headstone, which looks as though it's a new headstone. It's been replaced by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. And you'd simply walk past this one. It says 53276 Private J.W. Stevens, who is John Stevens from the New Zealand Otago Regiment. And he died on Christmas Eve 1917, 24th of December, aged 26. What's his story then, Johan? Why have you brought me to this one?
Well, we have with our group of volunteers, we have a friend of her. She's called Marijke. And when she was a kid, she walks here a lot with her parents over the cemetery. And she was always wondered about the date when this soldier died. He died on 24th of December 1917, Christmas Eve. And as a kid, she was always thinking, with Christmas Eve, shouldn't you be home with your family? Later on, she grew up, she forgot a little bit about the story. But when she's got older, she returned. and she tried to find out the complete story of John Stevens. And she found relatives of him. And she found out that the relatives are still commemorating John in New Zealand. So she lives in a complete southern point of New Zealand. And with Christmas Eve, they were always thinking about John. She had a good contact and she managed to arrange a visit to New Zealand on Christmas Eve.
She's gone all the way to New Zealand on Christmas Eve to see his family. And when was this? When did she go?
That was in 1917. 100th anniversary.
2017. Exactly 100 years later, she's gone to see the family of J.W. Yes. Stevens. And did they live in Otago in New Zealand?
They live in the complete southern point.
Right. Yeah. So how did that go when she went all that way?
It was a very emotional visit. Because like I said, the family still remembers Stevens. And it was like she became a part of the family.
I bet she did.
Yeah. So at Christmas Eve, she was invited over there.
Yeah.
But Christmas Eve in New Zealand is midday over here.
Of course.
So on the 24th December 1917, on midday, we held a big ceremony here.
At the grave.
At the grave of John Stevens with a live connection to New Zealand,
a Facebook link. Connection, have a video link
to New Zealand, so that the family was here at his 100th anniversary of his death.
And did the family know anything about him at all?
Yes, they had a complete story about him.
And a photograph.
A photograph, they have everything about it.
Yeah.
And even Marijke started a Facebook group, Dear John.
And it's still on there, is it?
It's still on there. If you want, you can go to the Facebook group, Dear John, and you can find out the story of John Stevens.
Brilliant. So as we wander around this beautiful cemetery, it even looks beautiful on a cold, damp November day. I remember coming here on that day, the Armistice Day of 2018, and meeting some German people that were stood between two German headstones just near the Cross of Sacrifice. It was tremendous to be able to talk to those German people about the reconciliation and about what this place means to them. They were mostly young people. So it begs the question then, who are those German casualties that are here then, Johan?
Well, there are two headstones with the markings of two bodies on each headstone. Three of them are unknown.
So there's actually four soldiers on the two headstones.
Yeah, and there's only one known, a guy named Otto Bieber. And he was killed on October the 4th, 1917, during the famous attack, which is known as the Battle of Broodseinde, when the Australians captured this position, Tynecott Cemetery.
So the chances are then he's died here and then been buried here.
He was killed here in one of the bunkers that is still remained on the cemetery, but we can't see it behind the pavilion and used by the Commonwealth War Grave Commission.
Right, yeah.
During the attack of October the 4th, the Germans retreated, panic. They met an officer and they said, we have to retreat, the Australians are breaking through.
Yes.
The officer called some men up and come to the bunker. But there are only two or three soldiers arrived at the bunker alive. Mm. Mm. Then the bunker was captured by the Australians. And only the German officer was taken alive. All the rest was killed during the action. So the young guy, Otto Bieber, was only 18 years old, was also killed here during this attack. His remains were buried next to the bunker. But with the construction of the wall of the Memorial of the Missing, the graves were a little bit on the way. And they have to be removed. And as the Commonwealth said, everybody is equal in death. Mm. They rebury them among their comrades in arms here on Tynecott Cemetery.
So the other three that are there, are they his comrades that were found with him, probably died on that day?
The one that is unknown, which is marked on the headstone of Otto Bieber, was found next to him, with him.
Yeah.
And the other two soldiers were found during the construction of the memorial, completely unknown German soldiers. And they buried them next to the other two German soldiers.
Now, the other feature when we walk into this cemetery, obviously, we describe it as a silent city, which it is, and it feels like that today. But the other feature that always amazes people is that they're in long lines, trenches. They were buried in shallow trenches here by the Imperial War Graves Commission, as it was then. But they look like soldiers on parade, don't they? They look like they're on a parade ground. And that's the case for well over 11,000 of them. But in a plot just behind the Cross of Sacrifice, there are irregular graves. They're sort of haphazard in the way they've been buried. Why are they different to the rest of the cemetery then, Johan?
Well, in fact, when the Australians captured Tynecott Cemetery, the central bunker, which is now under the Cross of Sacrifice, was used first aid post for the Australians. So all the Australian and British troops that were wounded in later battles, during the Battle of Passchendaele, were treated here in this bunker, and those who doesn't make it were buried around the bunker. So in fact, all the shattered graves that are standing here is the original Tynecott Cemetery battlefield cemetery.
And all the others then were brought in after the war by the Imperial War Graves Commission and buried in these long rows. But the original grave, I think it's 300 of them, isn't there? Something like that. They were left exactly as they were. They weren't exhumed and reburied. That's just as they were. And I think I can see some headstones over there. Isn't there 27 artillerymen or something that are buried in one plot? Do we know what happened to them?
All hit by artillery shells. They were all killed by the same shells. And their remains were completely mangled with each other, and it was very hard to find out whose remain belonged to whose body. And so they put them, not in a mass grave, because we never speak of mass graves with the British, but in a collective grave.
Yeah.
And the policy of the British is, we want to commemorate every single soldier by name. And therefore they put a headstone with sometimes 3, 4, 5 names on it to commemorate those soldiers that are all together in this collective grave.
Yeah. And I think those 27, I can see from here, they're under like 5, 6, 7 headstones. They've got that many headstones just so they can get all the names on, isn't it? And that they are all together. And the Cross of Sacrifice, which looks out right the way back across the battlefields, across the cemetery and back to Ypres, it's very impressive. It's one of the there's 4 different types of Cross of Sacrifice, and I would have thought that must be the largest one. There's some steps that go up to it, and that's built on top of one of those bunkers that you said was used as a medical post. What's the story behind the Cross of Sacrifice then? How did that turn out to be there? Whose idea was that?
During the King's Pilgrimage in 1921, King George was here with a lot of generals and architects, and he was standing on top of the bunker looking towards the cemetery, talking with his architects, and it was King George that said to the architects, why won't you place the Cross of Sacrifice here on this bunker and make a platform of it so that the relatives can come over, stand on the platform, look over the cemetery and look over the battlefields where their beloved ones were killed. So a lot of people said, oh, you can't climb on the platform. Mm. Not done. But yes, it's King George that said you can climb on the platform.
Well, that's why there's steps, isn't it? That's why there's steps there.
That's why there are steps, but you can't climb on the cross,
no,
of course.
No,
but on the platform, that's the meaning, to climb on top of it.
And then as we come round to the far side of the Cross of Sacrifice, we can see a little piece of an opening, really, and we can see the original pillbox, can't we? That's the only bit. And didn't it have the wrong Australian division on that for many years?
If you look to the front side of the bunker, you can indeed see a piece of the bunker with a bronze wreath, commemoration wreath, and it became a memorial of the 3rd Australian Division. But for long years, it was marked the 2nd Australian Division. But in the 1980s, they removed the 2nd and they engraved a tree in it.
So the next one we've come to see is a 2nd Lieutenant Arthur Conway Young, who was with the Royal Irish Fusiliers. And he's died on the 16th of August, 1917. So, is that the Battle of Langemark? 16th of August, 1917. Battle of Langemark is one of those battles that's within the Third Battle of Ypres, Battle of Passchendaele. And there's a very unusual inscription on the bottom of his grave. Tell us about that then, Johan. You read it out and tell us about it.
Well, Second Lieutenant Young was indeed killed August the 16th during what they call the Battle of Langemark. But in fact, he was killed in Zonnebeek near Friesenburg, with the attack of the Irish and the Scottish towards the village of Sonnebeke. Also in the same battles where the famous Father Doyle got killed. But what is very special of Arthur Conway Young, he is born in Kobe, Japan. He was the son of a British diplomat. And what even is more special is the personal epitaph that they put on the headstone. It says, sacrifice to the fallacy that war can end war. That was something they believed before the war, and they called up a lot of young men and they say, after this war, there will never be a war again. So it's a real political epitaph, and it's still a mystery why the Commonwealth allowed it to put it on his headstone.
I think that's very true, because one of the presentations that I do as a volunteer with the commission, we look at some of these inscriptions, family inscriptions, and they had a committee to decide whether they would be accepted or not. And there's numerous examples of political statements similar to that, criticising the war, criticising the governments, that were rejected by the Commonwealth or the Imperial War Graves Commission as it was then. But that is quite a challenging statement. I'll just repeat that: sacrifice to the fallacy that war can end war. It really is a controversial statement that, you know, people listening to this could argue about till the cows come home. But that's been allowed. And he came from, born at Kobe, which I think is now called Kyoto, isn't it, in Japan. And there's a lovely picture of him there. And on a number of graves around here, people have come and put a single rose, as a single white rose, in front of his grave. And some children, local children, have also come and put some pieces of art there that they've drawn as well. So it's an unusual story, that one, but well worth telling. And then either side of him, there are, just shows how many people died that day. There's an L. Boughton from the Royal Irish Rifles, same day, age 23. There's a J. Wallace, same day. And then we've got two soldiers that are unknown, but one of them we know is the Royal Irish Regiment. And that reminds us that over 70% of the burials in this cemetery are known unto God. We don't know who they are. Now, we talked about on the podcast before about coincidences, and I'm standing by the grave of a guy called Samuel Rudge from the Royal Berkshire Regiment, who was killed on the 3rd of October 1917 near here. This really is an example of how I believe that these soldiers are calling us in, because in 2000, and it might have been 2017 actually, or 2016, somewhere around there, we were doing the Soldiers Charities Frontline Walk, and the final morning, we're approaching Tynecott, very tired and weary after two and a half days of walking. And one of the guys who's walking with us comes up to me, and we're about half a mile from Tynecott. And he says, I've just been in touch with my auntie who lives in New Zealand. And she tells me that we have a relative and a great uncle that died somewhere on the Western Front. Do you think we'll be able to track him down? And I said, well, we can. I said, but the chances of him being here is very remote. So we got the details, and lo and behold, he said that he was buried in Tynecott. And I thought, well, there's only, what, 3,000 soldiers here that have a name on their headstone? The rest are on the memorial wall around the cemetery. Maybe he's one of those 35,000. But no, here he is. He does have a grave. And a few minutes after finding out about him, my fellow walker was kneeling down in front of his grave, absolutely distraught, in tears, getting very emotional about a man that just half an hour earlier he didn't even know existed. And there he was, on his knees, in front of the grave of this man that was his own blood. It was his own great uncle. And it was one of those memories that were forever stick with me. And whenever I come to Tynecott, I always come and see Samuel. And then next to him is a soldier of the Great War. And we know from looking at the Commonwealth War Graves Commission archives, the burial records, that he was found with him when these bodies were recovered after the war, not far from here. So we couldn't come to Tynecott without looking at a couple of Australian recipients of the Victoria Cross. We're looking at the first one, Sergeant 456 Lewis McGee from the 40th Battalion of the Australian Infantry. And he's died on the 12th of October 1917, aged 29. On the top of his headstone is what you'd expect, the Australian Imperial Force cap badge. And then on the bottom, the unmistakable image of the Victoria Cross with those words on it, for valour. And I know that Lewis died very close to here. And I know that he didn't die, did he, on the day that he was awarded the Victoria Cross. He died a few days later doing a similar thing. Tell us more about him. Tell us more about Lewis then.
Well, Lewis McGee was born in Tasmania, and he was part of the 40th Battalion of the Australian Infantry Forces, and they were nicknamed the Tasmanian Devils. On October the 4th, 1917, their task was to capture the final objective, which was the bunkers of Tynecott Cemetery. They crawled nearer into the battlefield, going from crater to crater, but they were fired by enfilated machine gun fire from Humber Farm. His commanding officer, Lieutenant Meager, was killed, and he was the highest in rank. And he decided to jump out of the shell crater and go in a straight line towards the German machine gun. He managed to reach it. He killed some of the German machine gun crew and took some others prisoners. As a heroic example of his attacks, the rest of his men followed and they managed to capture Tynecott bunkers. For his action, he was awarded the Victoria Cross. But a week later, they have to go and attack on October the 12th, 1917, and capture the ruins of the village of Passchendaele. He have to go through what was known Augustus Wood. And they came in a similar action. Machine gun fire on top of them. He jumped out of his shell crater, ran in a straight line to the machine gun, and a machine gun bullet goes straight through his head. He was killed instantly and was buried in the field next to Tynecott Cemetery. And in 1921, his bodies were brought over to Tynecott Cemetery, where he is resting now.
So those bunkers that you mentioned that they're attacking, are they the same ones that are here today? I know there was many others, weren't they? Do we know that for certain?
There were a lot of bunkers, but yeah. The bunkers that are still visible on the cemetery are part of the famous Flandern 1
yes.
defense line from the Belgian coast upwards to the Swiss border. But next to the cemeteries, on both sides, there were more bunkers in the fields. But most of them are destroyed after the war because the farmers want their field back. Just to give you an idea where Humber Farm was, yes. If you're standing at Louis McGee, his grave,
yes. And
you're looking to his grave, and then you go to the right side, yeah. And you look to the first farm you see in the field, just outside the cemetery, this is Humber Farm.
Within the trees over there,
yeah,
a little bit
the trees
to my right.
Over there. Pillbox, where the machine gun was, is still on the farm, but the farmer doesn't allow anybody on his
Have you ever
property.
Seen it?
I've never seen it, no. And there's only one picture existing of it.
Right. And I think the other thing to note about McGee is that we know he was shot through the head. There's an amazing photograph, isn't there, of his helmet in front of the original grave with a great big bullet hole in the top of it.
Yes, that's a famous picture of it with his original cross here, where it's standing now. But there's also another famous picture of King George standing in front of the grave of Louis McGee during
grave?
His pilgrimage.
Oh, I've seen that. And he's with Fabian Ware.
Fabian Ware and...
another dignitary. So Haig is there as well.
And Fiumer Haig.
Yeah.
And architect
I've often wondered
whose
grave that was. That's here.
Yeah.
Oh, we'll have to put that on the website then. Yeah. That's brilliant. Yeah. Something else you just thought of, Johan, about Sergeant McGee.
No. Well, first I can tell you a little bit about his family life.
Oh, please do.
Sergeant McGee married before the war with a 17-year-old Eileen. They had a little daughter, Nada. After the war, she was receiving the Victoria Cross. And in the 1980s, they became in a lack of money. And they decided to sell the Victoria Cross group, which remaining of the Victoria Cross, the British War Medal, and its Victory Medal, but also a German Iron Cross First Class that Louis McGee captured from a German
really?
Prisoner.
Took it off his, yeah.
And they sold it to the Tasmanian Museum for the price of then $34,000.
Wow.
If we compare it to the prices of today, it will be about 220 to 240,000 euros.
So the good thing about that is that that money helped them, made them financially secure, but it also meant that it didn't go into private hands, it's gone into a museum, so people that go to Tasmania will be able to see it then, won't they? Hobart, isn't it? Hobart is Tasmania. Be able to see those medals still.
Yep. And here on Tynecott Cemetery, we have three Victoria Cross holders buried.
Let's walk across then. We'll walk across.
And there are three of them mentioned on the wall of the missing that were never found back.
So we've got three Victoria Crosses that actually got graves in the cemetery. But we've got another three that have no known grave that are amongst the 35,000 that are on the curved wall that's on the back of the cemetery. And that tells us that there are still 90,000 soldiers from the Commonwealth that died here at Ypres, not just in 1917, but throughout the war, that still, as far as we know, have no known grave. And every one of those soldiers had a life and a family and hopes and aspirations. And what I always say to people when they come here is think of the soldier, think of the casualty standing behind his headstone, but then think of his parents standing behind him and his siblings and his cousins and his extended family and then all his friends. And then you see, you get an idea, it's not just 12,000 men that are suffering because of the death behind these headstones. It's probably hundreds of thousands of people that were affected by these 12,000, isn't it? plus, of course, the 35,000 on the wall as well. So we've now just come just a few yards from McGee's headstone, and we come upon a Captain Clarence Jeffries, another Victoria Cross winner. He's got a new headstone. And tell us about him then, because he's got a remarkable, obviously a remarkable story as well.
Captain Clarence Smith Jeffries was the commander of the 34th Australian Infantry Battalion, and they have also to attack Passchendaele on October the 12th, 1917. And just outside the cemetery, on the backside of the cemetery, there's another small hillside with a few bunkers. And one of the bunkers was known as Hillside Farm. And his task was to attack this bunker. But with machine gun fire, it was nearly impossible to take it. And by a heroic action, Captain Jeffries managed to climb on the bunker and to kill also a few of German machine gun crew and take the bunker. But during the fights, Captain Jeffries was killed and he died instantly and was buried next to the bunker. And then his body was removed to Tynecott Cemetery, where he is still resting now.
And I believe that his father came all the way from Australia to initially, just after the end of the war, to help try and find his body. He was unsuccessful, went back to Australia, but not long after he went back, he received notification that his body had been found, and during the 1920s, he and his wife came. And
we're going to look at some more graves in a minute, but as we say, there's at the moment, you can see two complete bunkers that are here, and I think there was thousands of these bunkers, weren't they, that the Germans had built across these ridges in three or four different lines between 1915 and 1917. And this really is a tremendous construction that's taken, when we look at it, it's taken some direct hits, but it certainly hasn't destroyed it. Would they use their machine guns inside these pillboxes, or would they come out and get on top? Do we know?
Well, this is one of the famous Flandern 1 defence bunkers. And it's not a machine gun bunker. So it means the machine gun is not inside the bunker to fire.
No.
What is the meaning of these bunkers? All these bunkers were connected with each other with trenches.
Trenches, yeah.
And if there's an attack always starts with artillery fire. So when the British artillery start fire, the German troops climb inside the bunker and they wait. And they look to the small gap in front of the bunker to see what happens. And they know the moment the artillery stops, they know infantry will attack.
On their way.
And then they will climb out of the bunker, put a machine gun on top of it, or next to it, and wait for the enemy to come, so they can fire them. The bunkers are built so in line that you put machine guns on each bunker, that the machine gun fire is overlapping himself in the battlefield. So you have a complete wall of machine gun fire, which is very hard to get through.
So there's probably a couple of hundred yards between here and the other bunker. So there's a couple of machine guns on there as well. And then the Australians that are coming across the field behind me are having to face this, what we call an interlocking arc of fire then, isn't it? So they're not firing necessarily directly on them. They're firing across them and creating a field of lead, really, isn't it?
Yes, and also there were some bunkers on the flanks. So they were also having flank fire.
Yeah.
From other small bunkers,
yeah,
which are built all over the place here in the fields.
It's a wonder
so
they got through.
About, as they has calculated a few years ago with the Memorial Museum in Passchendaele, there were about 1,000 to 2,000 bunkers here in this area of West Flanders. Some were still in constructions, others were already completely done.
And then we walk down to the what used to be the official entrance to Tynecott Museum, Tynecott Cemetery, until they built the visitor centre and the new car park. I don't know how long ago that was now. How long ago was that? Did they open that? Must have been 2015 years ago.
Queen Elizabeth II
opened the visitor centre. So now we're at the bottom of the cemetery. And the first thing I noticed is a row of headstones just inside the wall, the bottom wall in the cemetery. There must be 50 or 60 headstones there. And they're slightly different. What are those graves, Johan?
Well, these are what we called special memorials. And these are 84 headstones of soldiers that they know they are buried here on Tynecott Cemetery. But during construction or the reburial time in the 1920s, their original headstone was destroyed or the name Doc Tack was removed or something. And they didn't know where exactly they were buried. But as the Commonwealth said, everybody wants to be honored by name. They put a headstone against the wall, and on top of the headstone it's marked believed to be buried here or known to be buried here. So these 84 soldiers are 100% sure buried here on Tynecott Cemetery, but they didn't know or knew anymore where.
And then we walk down to a much smaller row of graves. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Nine soldiers from the Northumberland Fusiliers, and they look the same as all of the other headstones here. Eight of them are together, and one of them there's a headstone's width between where there's nothing, and he's on his own, and he's the only one that's unidentified. And they've all got the same, roughly the same, 13th, 14th of October 1917 date on. They're all Northumberland Fusiliers. One of them's an officer, 2nd Lieutenant Ablett. And I believe that these are the most recent burials here in Tynecott then. And I know you were here at the funeral, weren't you? So tell us, and you did some work on this, so tell us about these Northumberland Fusiliers.
Well, during roadworks in 2019 on the hamlet of De Reutel, which is a village between Zonnebeek and Beeselare, archaeologic research found some remains of trenches. And in the remains of trenches, they excavated the bodies of eight soldiers. About 50 yards further, they excavated another soldier. So then the research start, who were they? And they start to look to the artifacts that the bodies were carrying. And one of them had a golden wedding ring on his hands with his name on it. So it became very easy to find out that this guy was 2nd Lieutenant Ablett. And then by historical research and the war diaries, they could find out who was with him when they were reported missing. And on the hand of these war diaries and these files, they found eight names of the nine soldiers. The ninth one that is not identified was a soldier that was found 50 yards further. So after all this research, they organized a reburial. But during the big C problem, the COVID problems we had, it was all postponed until last year. And last year, on November the 13th, they were all reburied in the presence of the Duke of Kent.
And I said that one of them, Ablett, was an officer. There's two officers there, actually, the 2nd Lieutenant Brutie as well. Was it Ablett's identification that gave the clue, was it, did you say?
Was the wedding ring of Lieutenant Ablett that gave the clue and that led to the identification of the other soldiers.
As we know, Tynecott is in the heart of Belgium. And we know that most of these soldiers that are here are Commonwealth soldiers. And we're looking at a headstone now that is a soldier from the 5th Battalion of the Canadian Mounted Rifles, who's died here either on the 30th or the 31st of October 1917. He's won the military medal, but I can see from his name that it looks like it's a Belgium name. And I believe he's the only Belgium casualty within the 12,000 at Tynecott. So no, who better to tell us about a Belgium casualty than the local man, Johan. So tell us about him. Who was this man?
Well, we are standing at the grave of Lance Corporal Richard Verhage. And Richard Verhage was born in a small village near Ostende, between Ostende and Bruges, called Zerkenhem. He got married. He got a little kid. But in 1901, he decided to emigrate by himself to Canada, to the village of Saskatoon, where he became a tram conductor. He learned to meet another lady over there and he got married. The outbreak of the war, which happened here in Belgium, he has a feeling and he wants to come back to fight. So he joined the Canadian Army in 1916. He was moved to France and to Belgium, where he took part in the Battle of Mont Sorel, Hill 60. He was badly wounded over there because nearly the half of the regiment was blown away over there, was killed or wounded. He was one of the wounded. He nearly lost his eye, but he survived. Then he served in 1917 also on the Somme and in France. And in 1917, October, they returned to Passchendaele. And on the night of the 30th to the 31st October 1917, they had to attack a place which was known as a Woodland Plantation, which is on the other side of the hill next to a Tynecott Cemetery. Also, a lot of losses for the Canadians. Richard Verhage was mentioned missing, probably killed. And in 1920, when the Belgian farmer was returned and started ploughing his fields, he found the remains of an unknown Canadian soldier, which appears to be Richard Verhagen. So Richard is buried here on Tynecot. So he emigrated in 1901 to a country 10,000 kilometers away, and he died 40 kilometers from his home in a big war.
Irony, really, isn't it? Sad irony that he's gone all that way. He's come back to within a few miles, few kilometers of where he came from, and here he'll be forevermore.
So Tynecot is full of mysteries, more mysteries than probably any other cemetery, because there's more unknown soldiers here. Every time you walk past a headstone, you look down, you think, oh, one that's identified, you look at the personal inscription and it tells you a bit about the family and about him and maybe about another soldier from the family that was killed. But there's other mysteries here, and you've whispered to me the mystery of a missing bunker. Tell me about that.
Well, it's not in fact a missing bunker, but a bunker you can see. So we always tell there are five bunkers on Tynecot Cemetery. There are two bunkers in the front that you can see, yep, with trees around it. Then you have the central bunker underneath the cross of sacrifice.
Okay.
A fourth bunker is on your left-hand side underneath the kiosk used by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission.
Yep.
But another bunker is buried under the ground, about 30 centimeters deep under the ground in a corner of the cemetery.
Which corner?
In which corner, if you're standing in front of the cross of sacrifice looking to the entrance,
yeah,
it's on your left-hand side.
So roughly where we're standing now.
Then you look to the wall outside of the cemetery, and at one point you can see the wall coming down.
Yes.
There's a crack in the wall.
Yes.
There he is.
Right.
So,
but there's graves buried on top of it.
There are graves buried on top of them, but not a complete row.
Okay.
Because of this bunker. So when the Commonwealth start digging their graves, they couldn't get deeper than 30 centimeters because they are sitting on the roof of the bunker.
Yeah, yeah, they would have hit it, wouldn't they?
Yeah, yeah. So it's an incomplete row of headstones where the German bunker is.
Right.
So we come to another one of those graves that normally you would just pass, but the reason why we've stopped here is there is a United States flag in front of this grave, which simply says Private 267691 W.C. Parker. And he was with the 5th Battalion of the Canadian Infantry, who's died right at the end of the Battle of Passchendaele on the 10th of November. And he was 35 years old. But clearly, he's not a Canadian, is he? He's crossed the border, is he?
Yes, we are standing here at the grave of William Curtis Parker, who was born in Sioux City in Iowa. He married there. They got two children, but they lived in very poor conditions. And in 1910, they decided to emigrate to Canada, to Saskatoon, where they became farmers. In those days, they had two more children. With the outbreak of the war, Private Parker wants to join the army because he has British roots. His parents were from, his father from Scotland, his mother from England. So he wants to join and to fight for the British flag. But as an American civilian, he couldn't.
He's neutral.
He's neutral. So Australia was not, Canada,
America
was not in the war until April 1917. So he decided to join the Canadian Army in 1916. He had a lot of training, and it was only on November the 3rd that he arrived on the battlefields of Passchendaele, 1917. So he had about 1 year of training first in Canada, then in Great Britain, and then he served a little time in France, but as a reserve troop. And on November the 3rd, they arrived at Passchendaele. On November the 5th, they were sent to the trenches just outside Passchendaele. And on November the 10th, he saw his first actions. And they have to support the 8th Canadian Battalion during the attack on the east side of Passchendaele. He was a stretcher bearer at this moment. And when he was carrying away a wounded friend of him, a German shell collapsed, killed all the guys around the stretcher bearer. He was buried on the spot where he was killed, near a position which is now the water tower of Passchendaele. And in 1921, his body was removed here to Tynecot Cemetery. So he is what we called a U.S. Tommy. So he is born in America.
A U.S. Tommy.
And he became a Tommy. So he is a U.S. Tommy.
Who put the flag there?
Who put the flag there? Well, here in Flanders, we have an American cemetery called the Flanders Fields Cemetery. It has another name.
No, that's fine.
The Flanders Fields Cemetery in Waregem. And they commemorate all the American soldiers that were killed during World War One.
Okay.
But also those that served under another flag. So that served under Australian, New Zealand, British or Canadian flag.
In this case, yeah.
And with US Memorial Day, the last weekend of May, they plant American flags in front of all the headstones of these American soldiers, of these US Tommies. Here on Tynecot, we have 16 US Tommies buried. They also have a program called Adopt a US Tommy.
Yeah.
So you can adopt one of these American soldiers. And Private William Curtis Parker is the grave that I adopted.
You've adopted him, yeah? Yes. Do you feel very close?
We found out his complete story. I had contact with the family until 2 years ago. Then I don't have lost the contact for some reasons.
Is there a photograph of him?
I have photographs of him, of his wife, of his children.
Yeah.
So after his death, his wife returned to Sioux City, Iowa, with her four children. After the war, she remarried and she died in the 1950s.
Right.
And I had contact with the youngest grandson of William. They have visited the grave in the 1960s.
Oh, right.
So, thanks very much, Johan, for that. As I say, we've spent the last 45 minutes in, fortunately, my feet are frozen. We're all frozen, aren't we? But we can see the whole battlefield today because it's not foggy like it was yesterday. We've really just scratched the surface of talking about these. And I know that you've got many other stories to tell, but I really wanted to say thank you very much for spending your time with us today. You always do this. Whenever I come to Tynecot with a family group, you always come out and share these stories with the people that I bring here. And it's I think it adds a different perspective coming from a local guide because, you know, effectively, this is on your doorstep, isn't it? This is almost your back garden, and it's something that's been very close to you all of your life, really, isn't it? Since you said you came here with your dad. So thank you very much, Johan.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's a pleasure to share the stories of all these soldiers with people who don't know their story. So for me, it's a privilege to tell these stories so that their sacrifice lived on and they forever will never more. Be forgotten.
That's right.
So I hope you enjoyed that walk around Tynecot with Johan. And obviously there are many more stories to tell. And next year we'll return to Tynecot with Johan and we'll tell some more of those stories. So one last thing I just wanted to mention, and a number of people have contacted me about doing a battlefield tour next year. And of course, I'll be doing some family pilgrimages, but we will be doing a coach tour between the 12th and the 15th of May 2023. And this tour will be me leading it as a guide, and Ledger Battlefield Tours will be providing the coaches and organising the hotels and everything else that goes with it. So on day one of this tour, we'll be visiting Ypres. We'll be going to the Lichtenhoek Military Cemetery, where there are 10,000 burials. There's a visitor centre there as well. And of course, we'll be going to Tynecot, where no doubt Johan will put in an appearance and he'll talk to us about some of the graves that are there, some of the other graves that are there that we haven't mentioned in this podcast. And we'll then go down to Ypres to see the last post ceremony, which will take place outside of the Menin Gate, which will be closed for renovation for the next 3 or 4 years. On day two, we're going to go to the forgotten battlefield around Ober's Ridge and Loos. And we're also going to visit the Plug Street Memorial on our way down to the forgotten battlefield. On day three, we'll be travelling down to the Somme, where we're going to visit Tietval, Poisiers, Highwood, Troneswood, Sayre Road No. 2, which is the largest cemetery on the Somme, Gullimont, the Sheffield Memorial Park, and of course, the Loch Nagar Crater that we've talked about, and some other places as well. And on day four, we're going to visit Arras before we return home to the UK. So this will be a three-night tour. And if you want to get more details of this, then please drop me an email at terry@terrystours.co.uk and I'll send you the full itinerary. So the next podcast also comes from the Ypres Salient. And I recorded it the same time I went to see Johan a couple of weeks ago. And it comes from a place that many people that have been to Ypres will know. And that's the Hooge Crater Cafe and Museum on the Menin Road. And it's an interview with the owner, Nick, of the museum and cafe there. And that will be published in the first week of 2023. So all that remains is once again to thank you for taking the time to tune in, not just to this podcast, but to the hundreds of you that have tuned in throughout this year. Looking forward very much to next year. But to wrap things up for this year, once again, I'd like to pay the last post in memory of all of the 12,000 British, Commonwealth, even American and Belgian and German soldiers that are laying at rest in Tynecott Cemetery.